Road to Taken.
Oh, I've been waiting for this for months.
Senator Lyons.
Here.
Senator Pettijohn.
Here.
Senator Joseph.
Here.
Senator Ziegler.
Here.
Chairman Ray.
Senator Ray is absent.
Now, we have previously had assignments of bills. And I wish to change those assignments.
Why should we waive all the bills for the Destiny?
Obviously, Senator Ray is overworked. Those he assigned to himself should be changed and sent to me. All right. The first matter to be considered is the permanent fund dividend bill for individuals incarcerated after conviction, which we heard last meeting. Charles Christensen, representing Representative Barnes, is here again, and Tom Williams of the Department of Revenue is here. Mr. Christensen, did you have anything to add to your testimony? The other day?
Yes, Senator, I did.
Would you like to proceed?
Indulge me for a few more minutes.
We will indulge you.
Once again, for the record, my name is Charles Christensen. I'm an attorney in the Office of Representative Ramona Barnes. Quite frankly, I was taken aback when I testified before this committee on Monday. I did not expect to encounter the sorts of philosophical objections to this bill which were raised. Perhaps the reason I did not anticipate these philosophical objections is because none were made in the House, where the bill passed with a 37-0 margin. I am not certain why House members view this bill's objectives differently than do the members of this committee, but apparently they do. Very likely this was because of an inadequate presentation on my part on Monday. I hope to be able to rectify that at this time. I spoke with Representative Clarkson, a co-sponsor of this bill, shortly after he signed on as a co-sponsor. He told me that the reason he had done so was because the primary objective of this bill was not to punish felons, but rather was to provide compensation to the victims of violent crime. Gentlemen, this was not intended to be an anti-felon bill. It was intended to be a pro-victim bill. The Crime Victims Compensation Fund has been underfunded for years, and the House Judiciary Committee was advised by members of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board that they did not have enough money to meet their needs. I would point out to the committee that it currently costs the state over $29,000 per year to keep a felon in prison. By taking the permanent fund dividends from incarcerated felons and placing them in the Crime Victims Compensation Fund, these felons are relieving the state of the burden of appropriating money from the general fund to the Crime Victim Compensation Fund. The practical effect of this legislation is to require felons to reimburse the state in a very, very small way for the expense the state incurs as a result of the felon's illegal activity. As you are aware, for every state, for every dollar the state spends on incarcerating a felon, it has one less dollar it can give to the victims of violent crime. This bill has the benefit of providing perhaps $500,000 per year to the Crime Victim Compensation Fund, thus providing that fund with adequate resources which have been sorely lacking in the past. I understand that there is also some practical as opposed to philosophical concern on the part of committee members in that this bill would unconstitutionally deny the right of a felon to receive a dividend. This concern is not warranted. I would agree that if this bill applied to felons who were on probation, on parole, or under suspended imposition of sentence, that its constitutionality would be open to question. In fact, the House Finance Committee received testimony to that effect from the Office of the Attorney General. This is because the federal and state courts have held that a felon who is on probation or parole has all the same legal rights as an average citizen. In order to justify taking a specific right away from a felon who is on probation or parole, the state must show a rational interest in denying the right, and it must show that this rational interest outweighs the interest of the felon in retaining that right. To give you an example, the state can limit the right of a parolee to travel, because it can show that it has a rational interest in keeping a close watch on the whereabouts of a person who is released from prison before completing his sentence, and that this interest outweighs the parolee's interest in going wherever he wants. Possibly the state could not show a rational interest in denying a dividend to a felon on probation, parole, or SIS that outweighed the felon's interest in receiving the dividend. Because of this, and because the primary purpose of probation and parole is rehabilitation rather than punishment, the House passed the version you have before you. A legal analysis for denying rights to an incarcerated felon, however, would reach an entirely different result. First, Alaska Statute 33.30.310 states that a judgment of imprisonment in the penitentiary for a term less than for life suspends the civil rights of the person sentenced. Even if, however, the state were required to show a legitimate interest for denying a dividend to a felon in prison, it could do so. First, unlike probation, parole, or SIS, which the courts have held it for rehabilitative purposes, the courts have held that punishment of an incarcerated felon is a legitimate state interest. As Senator Ziegler pointed out on Monday, this bill does have the effect of additional punishment to a felon. However, because the primary purpose of this bill is not additional punishment for felons, I would ask you to key in not on this particular legitimate interest, but rather on the primary legitimate interests in denying dividends to incarcerated felons. First, as I stated, it costs the state $29,000 per year to keep a felon in prison, and the state has a legitimate interest in getting some of that money back for use in other programs, such as the Crime Victims Compensation Fund. Second, the state has a legitimate interest in seeing that felons, as a class, pay compensation to the victims of crime. Because this bill's objectives and practical effects are worthy, I would respectfully urge this committee to pass the bill in the form it was received.
Thank you. Now, the only thing that occurs to me is that the person who goes into a bank and attempts a robbery but doesn't come out with any money would obviously, and doesn't injure anybody, would obviously not have a victim in the sense of one eligible for a compensation fund.
That's true.
But in that situation, that offender would lose his dividend to put into the victim's compensation fund.
That's
I guess
true.
The argument is that if the person had been successful, there would have been a victim.
In a sense, the state is a victim in a case like that because the state has to go to the expense of prosecuting the person and placing him in prison. And the state as a victim is receiving compensation in the form of not having to appropriate general funds to the crime victims fund.
Senator Lawson.
Well, I don't think the person, if he had committed the crime, could also not, would not be a victim in the sense of a compensation.
Yes. Other questions or questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Christensen. Thank you. Mr. Williams?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Williams. I'm the Director of the Enforcement Division, Department of Revenue. I'm basically here today to answer any questions that you might have. As I understand, we have already testified on this bill, and if there's any additional questions, I'd like to address this.
Well, the testimony that I recall we had to do with the feasibility of a possible community substitute, which would have paid over monies to the spouse or dependent child, if any, of the person, rather than see it as cheap in a sense to a state. And the testimony was that was a very difficult thing to do as a practical matter because of the cross-checking. Now, with regard to the original bill, what is the department's position?
Mr. Chairman, our position is that we could administer the original bill. Basically, the way we would do that is obtain a list from the Department of Health and Social Services, match that list against our permanent fund dividend application files, deny those people that came up in a match, and we would also endeavor to handle the deals. Our position still is that it would be very difficult to administer a program wherein we would have to separately identify a spouse of those felons or the children. Extremely difficult, if not impossible, to administratively.
Any questions, Mr. Chairman? Yes, sir.
It seems to me, and I listen to Mr. Christensen very carefully, it seems to me that we're being painted in a tight corner, that if we don't like this bill, then we're against violent crimes victims and the compensation that we do them. And I don't like that necessarily. I don't think this bill is really a well-thought-out bill. Well, apologies are extended if they're necessary. I really don't, because to get back to the point that I was harping about the other day, you have a misdemeanor who's in there for 364 days, and the next cell, you've got a felon who's there for 1 year and 1 day. One guy is not going to get his dividend check, and the other one is. And I don't understand the rationale behind this type thinking. And if the guy is in there for a year and a day, that should be enough penalty. You know, I mean, he was given his jolt when he went before the sentencing judge, and now you're going to say, in addition to being incarcerated, now we're going to hit you in the pocketbook. We're going to get you coming and going. And there's something about this which does not appeal to me. I don't think it's fair.
Of course, I think that Mr. Christensen said that there was a loss of civil rights in the case of one fellow and not in the case of the other. By is that right?
It's true that you can make the distinction between the very basic distinction between a misdemeanor and a felony sentence, and that one is for less than a year and one is for a year and a day or more. However, the actual reason to make the distinction is because felonies are considered much more serious crimes than misdemeanors, regardless of the length of time it's imposed. And you can see this in that we impose far more penalties in addition to imprisonment for felonies. For example, when a person is convicted of a felony, in addition to his year and a day, he loses his right to vote, he loses his right to hold public office, he loses his right to be a member of a licensed profession, he loses his right to own a firearm. There are many additional penalties that are added to a felony term of imprisonment, and that is because a felony is considered a much more serious crime than misdemeanor.
In addition to which, you're taking away money that legally would belong to him, or not for the fact that he's in the pope. I might point out to you that Senator Pettigrew and Senator Justice and I are all attorneys, and we understand the difference between a misdemeanor and a felony.
Senator Lassen.
I'm not.
I have a,
you may be lucky.
I have. I'm sure I am. I have a practical question. No, the time frame we're working with. What are the dates of a permit fines? Are they in calendar year, fiscal year, or what? What are the eligibility dates? Would change them around, or where are we on that particular point?
Mr. Chairman, the eligibility period extends from October 1st through March 31st. It's a 6-month period. And the filing period then starts for
October 1st?
October 1st.
So on this bill here, if somebody went into the slammer September 15th, then they'd have to not only give up that year's dividend, but they also have to give up the next year's dividend. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, under Section 1, subsection D, it says an individual incarcerated, it says during all or part of the eligibility period for that year's dividend, an individual went in a jail, say, 15th of September, 1983, and were not released prior to October 1st of 83, they would lose their eligibility for the 1984 dividend.
Is that what it says? It's talking about a sentence that stretches over those two periods. Seems to me that you could withhold payments for 2 years. That's
the eligibility period is only 6 months, and it's the 6 months.
It's only 6 months.
That's correct.
Well, I don't know.
Wait, now
this relates to the eligibility period.
Right, that's be a year, right?
For a year, when during all or part of the eligibility period for that year's dividend, as a result of the conviction, the individual is incarcerated for a felony.
Mr. Chairman, the eligibility period for a permanent fund dividend extends now, only 6 months. And, for example, the eligibility period for the 1984 dividend, that year's dividend, 84, would be October 1st, 1983 through March 31st, 1984.
But when we say incarcerated for a felony, excuse me, are you referring to convictions, post-conviction incarceration?
Yes, that's correct.
How do I know that from other than you're saying so? In other words, if I'm arrested for a felony, not I, Senator Pettigrew is arrested for a felony, and goes out on bail and is acquitted, as he would be, would the department have to do something here, or how do I know this is post-conviction?
Senator?
Yes.
It says as a result of the conviction.
All right, excuse me, okay.
Can we go back in the time frame again?
Yeah, sure.
Well, someone with a year and 1 day, they would lose 2 years dividend, is that right?
Yes, I believe they would.
They'd lose 2 years then, right? How about the other 364 days they're out of the Huascal?
I'd like to revise my answer on that. It would depend on when that year sentence started. For example, if a person was convicted, was incarcerated April 1st of 1984, they would, and were released April 2nd of 1985, they would only lose 1 year's dividend because their incarceration extended only over the 6-month period, eligibility period for the 85 dividend, October 1st, 1984 through March 31st, 1985.
Well, I guess we could conceivably say that half of them would lose 2 years and half of them would lose 1 year. Depends on which side of the
that's
the
right.
Days.
Another instance would be an individual who was incarcerated January 1st of a year.
Right, okay, let's get back to the basic thing. Are we saying that some people, by virtue of the fact they were incarcerated at this particular time, are going to lose 2 years versus someone else who has the same sentence but happens to be incarcerated at a different time only loses 1 year?
That is correct.
And they're both for the same crime, for the same punishment, but one is losing 2 years dividend, one losing one.
Depending on when the sentence begins.
Right, now that's fair. I mean, that's...
Well, I thought that this bill says that... When do you pay the 1984 dividend? When is the check going to go? What period?
When will we mail the check?
The
check payments will begin first part of October of 1984.
And that is for the year 1984?
That is for the dividend year 84.
When does the dividend year 84 begin?
I suppose the dividend year would correspond to the eligibility period.
When is the eligibility period?
For 84, it begins October 1st, 1983, and ends March 31st, 1983.
Okay, so if you were in prison beginning in April of 84 for 20 years, you could draw the 1984 dividend at least, because you would not be in prison between October and March, 83 to 84, correct?
That's correct.
And if you were in prison for 20 years and got out in September 83, you could get the 84 dividend.
That's correct.
Do you have a chart?
No, I just drew up a chart. And if you're in prison during those month periods, that's... Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions of Mr. Williams? If not, thank you.
Oh, one other question. Could we address this?
He's the non-lawyer who asked the best question.
Yeah. Well, we have a proposed amendment. Have you seen that?
I have not.
This isn't really an amendment. This is language that was talked about, and this is in another permanent fund bill, so I just included it, so it's not really an amendment, it's just, it was talked about last week, about court-appointed attorneys or court-appointed restitution.
I guess my question is, if this was incorporated in this bill, would it do what I hope it would do? Would we give that first count on those monies?
2% of the money. My substitute. This first creates an exemption from levies, executions, and attachments of half the permanent fund dividend. Then it denies that 50% exemption for proceedings to satisfy child support obligations, and the additional language would deny the 50% exemption in the case of collecting a debt over the state or a court order of payment or restitution for victim of a crime.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
As a point of information, there is as mentioned previously, there is a House Bill 564 in the House right now, which does address something very similar.
But this would be compatible with the major legislation we're talking about here. I mean, is that logically inconsistent?
Yes, it would be very compatible, and point of interest, the Department supports eliminating the exemption as relates to debt owed to the state.
So this is for a victim's crime compensation.
We would have no problem with that.
Except for the one I'm interested in. How do we? That's the child enforcement.
It's already in there.
Okay, the question is that would they receive their funds prior to these monies being going to the state for whatever purpose?
The question is one of priorities. I think it would depend on who got there first. Who got the first letter? if the child support people were more diligent than the other agencies, the child support would pick it up.
There wouldn't be any, would there, Senator? If we're making a felon ineligible for a permanent fund dividend, there's nothing to garnish.
Well, only if he's incarcerated.
Yeah, if he's incarcerated, if he's in jail. There's not going to be any money to go out, going out that anybody can have half of or anything.
But he could be out of jail, and this could apply to a debt owed. Could be not a criminal at all. It could apply to a child support obligor or a debtor owing the state money. Those conflicts could arise.
Yeah, but
he could be a criminal who was not incarcerated.
The title of the bill is an act relating to permanent fund dividends for individuals incarcerated after conviction for felony.
That's true. We have a problem with the title as to the ability of the Second House to amend the title of a bill that's come over to us, which is something we should have addressed this morning.
Yeah.
It's a terrible rule, but there it is.
Just put the rule in.
Mm-hmm. I know, but I mean, this is what it does. This is why it, I don't want to get into that, but but since Neil is here, say this to him. I think the rule means that the Second House can't apply the accumulating wisdom about a subject matter, you know, conveniently. It's got to go back to scratch again. I think it's silly.
Are you saying that this particular exemption that I'm advocating could not be incorporated in this bill we had before us?
You think it can't?
You think it can't? I'm not looking at this. I'm looking at a method of doing using this here language doesn't really. We can exempt those dividends which are taken from those particular people who are incarcerated to go to this particular program.
I'm saying
we're still following that title.
The new language applies to all people who owe debts of any nature to the state.
I'm worried about that language. No, the concept being that if in fact these people who are incarcerated and the state is applying for the permanent fund dividend and they owe child support, that the child support agency will receive their cut before the state gets.
We could do this. I think we could amend this language to say that except if they're in jail, they wouldn't get it. As Senator Pettijohn says, there wouldn't be a permanent fund dividend to levy upon anyway, so it's moot. Because this bill says you won't get your dividend. You lose it anyway. So there's nothing left to attach to it.
Senator, you could change the intent language in Section 5.
Which word? Section 5 is what?
Section 5.
The CS? I don't think we're talking about the CS, because we have all those mechanical problems. Oh, it's in the original bill.
It's in the original bill. Change the intent language on where the money should go to.
Of course, you got to break it down into individuals. That's a
problem. You mean on an individual basis to put it in the violent crimes compensation fund if the offender perpetrated a crime that is within the fund or for child support or for debt to the state, as the case may be.
As the case may be.
What would that do in terms of your administration? In other words, do you understand what we're saying?
Would you run by the...
Okay, John Doe is in prison. Mary Rowe is in prison. And Richard Schmoe is in prison. And John owes child support, so the permanent fund dividend would go to him. And Mary was a violent criminal, and there is a... And her victim is getting money through the violent crime board, and so her money would go to that. And Richard owes the state a debt, and his money, his dividend, would go to the state to pay that debt. Can you do that?
Mr. Chairman, it's a practical matter. That's getting pretty complicated and difficult to administer. Primarily, maybe I should explain our process a little bit more. Before we start making payments on the dividends, we check our files to see if we have any attachments served on the department. Those take a certain order of priority.
Mm-hmm.
As a practical matter, what we would do to administer this is we would make a match and between H&S has its list of incarcerated felons and our PFP file and deny those individuals. Once those individuals are denied, we would be in a position then of having to monitor to see if any other sort of attachments came in against those individuals. Then we would have to turn around, make those individuals, not make the individuals eligible, but to try to isolate how much how many attachments came in against individuals who were denied.
And of course, any one of these people could be in all three categories.
And then you've got to set priorities for that. Without any specific facts right here to support it, I would say it would be something that would be difficult to administer.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you. Are there any other persons wishing to speak to the committee on this bill? If not, what is the committee's pleasure?
Mr. Chairman, I think I have a, I'm not really satisfied with the way that he's incarcerations differently, just because a period of time they happen to go to jail. They're all serving the same sentence, but they happen to be thrown at different times a year. One of them's going to lose 2 years, the other's going to lose 1 year. And, you know, is there some way we can resolve that? I don't know, but it seems to be not.
Probably could.
Even if the bill itself is fair, those things aren't fair.
You could make it, you could just say, during all of the eligibility periods, so take out or part. And that would cut down on the inequity to a certain extent. But you would, in order to be denied for 1984, you got to be in there from October 1 to March 31st, and then you'll be denied.
Okay, that would treat them all equally.
Right.
Or would it?
Well, it depends on when you go in. You could serve a year and a half, and it would be just depending on when you came up for sentence.
Yeah.
Well, they let you up. Oh, I see nothing's happened.
We've done a lot of reassignments.
Yeah, I reassigned a lot of stuff. We're talking about CSHB 575, related to permanent funding.
I can see that you were going to get out of the down here.
I'm closer to the witnesses. That's
Which one are you after?
575, permanent fund dividends. And we've heard more testimony from Mr. Christensen than from Mr. Williams of the Department of Revenue.
And what did you decide?
We haven't decided. Is there a motion before the committee?
What did they say to you? Anything?
Senator Lassen?
Well, now, I have two questions. One, has this point been brought up in the House discussion about those date periods?
I don't recall it being brought up in judiciary. I didn't attend the Finance Committee meeting, so
I mean, this is the first time they looked at the effects of something.
As I recall, someone did mention this to me, and the decision was that there was no way to resolve it.
Yeah, we don't care. He's in jail anyway.
The money would be put in the crime victims compensation fund, so it would be going to a good source.
Senator Ray?
This gentleman is representing Ms. Barnes, and Ms. Barnes told me that she wasn't interested in any amendments to this, and she wondered why it didn't pass, because it passed the House 40-0. And so I would say that perhaps if you're thinking about changing it, you should go back and tell, we'll have to go back and tell Ms. Barnes that we're going to make a committee substitute and change the concept of it, or just vote directly on it, either yes or no on this, and if you say no, it'll stay in the committee, and if it's yes, it'll go on the floor.
But the problem we're discussing now is that the time frames, the way the bill is drafted, two people, one, they're both commit the same crime, they both get a year and a day in jail, and they're both incarcerated, but at different periods of time. And one of them is going to lose 1 year's dividend, and the other one's going to lose 2 years' dividends.
Because the October to March
because
period is the only period that this residency test, this incarceration test would be at.
Is that a fair statement of what you said about Ms. Barnes' position?
Mr. Williams gave his testimony from the Department. Okay. Are there further comments?
Are you mean we can't amend the bill, is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm not bound by Ms. Barnes' desires either to vote for the bill or leave it as it is. I mean, I respect them, but I don't have to do the wrong thing.
You're missing what I said. I didn't say that you to do the wrong thing. I said that if you felt that you wanted to change it, the concept of it, that perhaps we would put a bill in from the judiciary and change it and put it in under the concept that you want, and just leave this alone and it'll stay in committee or it'll go out on the floor.
Well, I think the concept that I had drafted is probably not workable from the administrative point of view, so I'm not pitched to that. Or we could talk to Ms. Barnes if we have any amendments worth thinking about. At this time, is there any further motions on this bill?
Well, I would say that ask me to direct the chair to contact Ms. Barnes again and say there's very little support for the original concept of the bill and tell her exactly how what the opinion of the committee is. If that's agreeable, is that agreeable to you?
Yeah, I'm not saying I'm opposed to the bill, though. I might very well vote for it.
I think it's flawed.
It's what?
Flawed.
All right, is there objection to that? If not, Chairman Ray will talk to
him. I'll talk to him one or two.
Okay, Senator, you wish to take over now for Senate Bill, House Bill 504?
Oh, yeah, okay. 504, yeah, I'm going to give you 504. Thank you, Mr. Vice.
Well done.
My story of business is House Bill 504, establishing the Teacher Scholarship Loan Program, and we have Neil. You want to come forward and identify yourself and give a little testimony to the building?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Neil Phelps Munson, representing Speaker Joe Hayes. House Bill 504, the members have had an opportunity to read it. It's very plain on the face of it. It addresses a problem which has been approached by a number of other devices over the years, and none of which has been particularly effective. This one is a pretty simple concept. It simply is an effort to entice rural Alaskans to become school teachers and return to rural Alaska to teach. The bill's been pretty thoroughly refined by three separate committees, and the Speaker's office is confident that what began as a very good concept has become very good legislation. You have here today to testify a much more expert witness than myself, in person, Dr. Kerry Romsberg, who knows the technical aspects of the bill and how it would be administered. I think perhaps the one further thing I should say outside of answering any questions you might have is that it has received very, very broad popular support. I'm sure that many of the members of this committee have had correspondence on it, and our office, of course, had a great deal of it. It seems a very sound bill.
Are there any questions, Mr. Phelps Wilson?
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, sir. Mr. Ellsberg?
Thank you. I'm Kerry Romsberg, Director of the Commission on Post-Secondary Education. The bill itself is another loan program, a little different than the existing student loan program, in that the conditions of this program incorporate those for the regular student loan program and add a few things. And those conditions are really outlined in a couple of areas, and if you will, I'll just talk through this thing with you. Under the administration of the bill, the commission, which is referred to as the committee here, the loan committee is in fact the commission by statute, the commission would allocate the number of loans available to school districts in the state, and this would be done on some kind of a priority basis based upon their definition of rural and whether or not they serve communities of under 4,500. Those school districts and the local school boards would then choose the recipients of these loans and would make the awards to the individuals based upon additional criteria they might set forth. The conditions of the loans are similar in that they are 5% loans. There would be a 10-year repayment period. Forgiveness would apply the same way it does with the existing loan program, except if you'll notice on page 3, lines 6 through 16 indicate that if the borrower meets the conditions that are set up for the regular program, and that means they complete their program of study, and then if they're employed as a teacher in rural Alaska, instead of getting 50% of their loan forgiven, they would get 100% forgiven. So it's an incentive, a reward for the individual to return to the state if they've been outside or remain in the state, if they had their schooling inside, and then to teach in rural Alaska or a rural school. Again, rural is defined as a community under 4,500. Another difference on line 17 of page 3, instead of the borrower being able to get $6,000 for this undergraduate study, they would be able to borrow up to $10,000. And then the
That's in a school year, but how much is the
What's the total? $40,000?
They could borrow, since the other conditions apply as to the regular program, they could borrow for no more than 5 years of undergraduate study, which means they could get up to $50,000, if indeed they could meet the
criteria. Then they come back and teach 4 years in school in Alaska, for which they get paid, and they also amortize the 100%?
That's correct.
Do they also get the regular student loan, post-secondary student loan?
No.
I wonder if it's... Do we use the federal funds in this program at all?
No.
And we won't?
No.
Nothing but state funds?
That's correct. There aren't any federal funds in either of the loan programs any longer, other than those we receive from interest that we receive from old loans we made.
There's no federal funds in the scholarship loan program?
Only interest that we get from loans we made back in 1971. There is some federal interest money we receive.
In other words, what's really going on is that the ceiling on the 5% loan goes from $6,000 to $10,000 in these special cases.
Right. And there's another additional change, too.
There is the more liberal forgiveness feature in exchange for specific services as teachers.
And one more change that I haven't got to yet, which is on the find on line 20 on page 3. The current loan program, you can only use loans for expenses of books, tuition and fees, room and board. This adds transportation expenses for 2 round trips between the loan recipient's home and the school. So you've added transportation for these individuals. So that's the other difference.
Mr. Chairman, sir, do you have data indicating that we are having difficulty recruiting rural Alaskans to become school teachers? I have no knowledge as to if or not Native kids, rural kids, have an interest in education and are beginning to drift back to the villages.
We have indication from our high school senior survey that a large number of the individuals would indicate a desire to be a teacher. And whether or not it be rural in Alaska or not, we don't know, because we only ask them their profession, their goals, and they indicate that they're interested in education. But there is substantial data indicating that there is a problem with recruiting and retaining teachers in rural Alaska, particularly those that do come from rural Alaska in the first place. Some school districts have testified in previous hearings that they have as much as 100% turnover in their teachers. And the large reason for that is the teachers that are placed are recruited from outside the state of Alaska, or for someone who's not familiar with the conditions in rural Alaska. They get out there and they'll stay.
Mr. Chairman, is that because the RENA chooses to get the outsider, or because there doesn't elect to hire the native eligible certificated teacher, or because there aren't the native certificated teachers?
Largely it's because they're not available. Right now there's the Arctic program. It's XSEED now, I'm dating myself, it used to be called Arctic, now it's XSEED, Cross-Cultural Education Program out of the University of Alaska Fairbanks that works with rural students and tries to train them as teachers, but that's the principal source for native, in this case, rural students to be teachers.
But would this have a tendency to provide perhaps inferior teachers rather than that they have a full? Where's the incentive for anybody to hire the native teachers? You'd have to have an incentive for them. It's just not for them to get the money off, but somebody have to hire them and then get anything off anyway.
The only incentive there's no incentive built into this bill at all that would for hiring them. The incentive would be that there is a need as identified in previous testimony, and I can't give you data on that based on my experience, but we can tell you that the school districts and the school boards, particularly in the rural parts of the state, testified through teleconference, and it was unanimous testimony in support of this kind of an approach that would help them to identify and recruit students from rural Alaska to teach in those rural districts.
Well, I think it's much too lenient. I think that the 100% write-off is, I could support 100%.
The position of the Commission on Post-Secondary Education on this bill is that we met last weekend and discussed it at some length, and we endorse the concept of the bill. We do have some problems, as I had indicated earlier, with a loan limit of $10,000 and the size of indebtedness an individual may accrue under this, but there is justification for having a higher loan limit, and I would like to point out what that is, as per the
sponsor. I'll ask another question.
Oh, sure.
Well, I was wondering, well, of course, the transportation thing is bigger than $10,000, but I wonder if we're training people for jobs that really don't exist. There's some Department of Education going to testify on this. It seems to me that And we were told that from experience I've had in our school district that they have files for applicants for teaching positions in that district. It certainly could be different out in rural Alaska, but we're still talking about that type of labor market. And to put somebody $40,000 in debt and then not be able to get a job would be much assistance to them.
In fact, Senator, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Senator, that was one of the concerns we had when the bill was first drafted, is that once we get some placement, some products from this program, and they do get placed, assuming that they do, then what happens to the next crop and the next? Are there still going to be jobs? The bill was originally drafted, had no forgiveness. You either got 100% or you got none. This bill doesn't do that. So if the individual finishes their degree and lives here, even if they can't get that job teaching, they still get the same 50% forgiveness that anyone else would, but they don't get the 100%, and indeed they would be in debt an additional amount.
So that student A and student B were equally worthy. One gets hired in debt, one gets 100% forgiveness, and the other through no fault of his own.
That's correct. You're rewarded for service in those districts.
Mr. Chairman, I like the bill, but I think that there probably should be some kind of automatic sunset on it, because we might 6, 7, 8 years from now find that we don't really need it. This doesn't make any sense from a policy point of view, either because we have a surfeit of trained Native teachers who are already at work, or because it's there are other reasons. But I think just to make it perpetual means that in 1995, well, we could have no real public policy need for this, and still be giving special loan to a special kind of group.
Don't you find it in a way it's reverse discrimination?
I think they call that affirmative action.
The question was raised in terms of legal protection, and the bill went through a number of revisions based upon information from the Attorney General's office and settled with the language that is currently before you. First, it talked about minority teachers, then it talked about Native teachers, and now it is talking about rural. And that was to try to get around that equal protection problem that the Attorney General raised.
Mr. Chairman, you haven't mentioned this, Dr. Rosberg, but what is your professional view that you have on as to whether Native students or rural students do better if they are taught by people of like ethnic or cultural background, as opposed to the Harvard graduate with a 5A Kappa key who doesn't share that background?
I can only quote your studies. I have no personal.
Or I understand what you said.
The data would indicate, research would indicate, when you're dealing with a population where there's a language difference, which indeed this population would be included, that if you do have an individual in the classroom, a teacher or an aide that can speak the language that
sides of the public is teaching, he or she is teaching.
That's been proven many times, that's correct.
And also have a level of competency in the standards too.
Well, I've been told, and I have every reason to believe it's true, that specifically put that student or that teacher back into their own community. They have they have developed problems other teachers do not have because of the fact they were raised in that area. But putting them in some other rural school could be entirely different. But I know, for example, there's that number of problems of our local people coming back to teach. And they're carrying the burden of their childhood plus the professional part of the problems. That's right. That's the truth.
It's tough
stuff. What goes to some other community, that's something else again. I don't know.
I know exactly the same kind of cases. This, by the way, this doesn't say you go back to the same thing.
Oh, I know. That's I should say you don't go back. But as I understand, Mr. Chairman, that someone apply for the small as a teachers under the scholarship program and receive it and go ahead and take any type of particular course they would like. Are there any open hands there?
Yes, Senator, that's a very good question. The answer is yes, that's good.
Well, I'm going to take the same thing.
I should have mentioned that, of course, the Native student might be the person who might get the carpet with a 5A but that Native student is so educated would be more incompetent. Best of both worlds. High competency plus cultural orientation.
second call from someone that perhaps has less, just with a less high academic standings and following just because that person came from a rural school or a rural community of less than 4,500 people. You don't call it discrimination.
I don't try to defend the bill in terms of equal protection in any way, so.
But you were talking about the background of the Attorney General's office, and I want to strike that into that part of it.
No, the question was a general equal protection question.
And they wanted to write it so that it wouldn't reflect that.
That's right.
Should we proceed a little bit further? It seems like it opens up sort of a bag of works here. Anyone who comes from a rural area, Alaska, who wants to go on to college for whatever purpose they can apply for this particular loan, get $10,000, and then after 4 or 5 or 6 years, whatever it takes, they come back and say, well, I'm not going to be a teacher, but I'll live in Alaska and do something else. I didn't really intend to be a teacher, but I got the teacher loan because I'm feeling
they would have to sign, an intent statement that indicates here that they intend to teach.
Yes.
The attorneys on this panel can tell you intent is something that's very difficult to enforce. But as long as they sign that document indicating that that's their intent, then should they change their mind some public.
What if that teacher is of exceeding brilliance and such as much sought after, and they want her to teach in West Anchorage High School? That she has to pull, she has to pay back the full loan because she isn't teaching in a rural level in secondary school.
They make 50% because they would still be eligible for the regular 50% forgiveness. So they would get the same forgiveness as any other individual who would work and pay their fee.
But the same. But her classmate that wasn't very smart and went back and teach him, and had a 2 week pass at 100% after 4 years.
That's
what happened. They have to change that somehow.
Mr. Chairman, you would have got regulations, I assume, on some of these points. But if Brady B enrolled in our show evidence of intent to enroll, if a student said, I wanted to be a teacher, and then went to the Joseph Deacon's House of Duty to be a study cosmetology, you would cut that situation off with advance, I suppose.
Sorry.
Active advance.
I'm trying to figure out what this language is on page 4 is. Meet the conditions set by the student local school board with respect to the district's requirements for teachers in particular subject areas. You've got a high school kid who, and you know, the school board wants, let's say, math teachers, or science teachers.
I think we'll look at this set up by those.
I don't mind
giving them some money that they don't get any more than 50% as far as I'm concerned. I don't care if they were 50 years last.
50%, yeah.
That's my own feeling, Jim.
I just wonder, you know, Mr. Chairman, if this is really, you've got a young native kid in a barrel or someplace, and he's trying to decide what he's going to do with his life. He's 17 years old. He's thinking, well, I guess I'm going to become a teacher. Because if I become a teacher, I can get more money, and then if I come back and teach, I can get it all forgiven. Is that the kind of motivation that you're going to give to somebody to become a good teacher?
That isn't that motivation I need.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Page points a good point, because I'm not sure I reached the same conclusion, but I think it's a good question to ask.
But if you kind of make diversionaries out, instead of getting people to work with that's why I thought if you give them 50%, you can tell whether they want them to or not. They still got the extra. They got the extra perks in there anyway. Why make them and all the rest of it? They get first consideration and all the rest of it. So it's kind of like a dollar.
An ethnic hire.
It's not too different from the U.S. Marines.
They provide the U.S. Marines offer potential sales of scholarships for providing a stupid thing.
Like if you go to a service academy in 4 years and then have to put 5 years in just to learn to start with. So why don't we say that they have to come back and work for 5 years in order to get the loan? Get nothing off. Be happy to get it.
That's what happened to teachers out
of the they're unhappy now.
Mr. Chairman, if you're
has been that it is the beginning evidence of the problem. It's a teacher turnover. Well, it's up to 100% in some districts. The average is 40% across those districts identified for all in the state. All right. A high percentage of the teachers who are going to rural high school are from outside the state. They're from all over the country. A lot of them come up here for an adventure. They spend a year or two, and they are dissatisfied. Rural, raised, educated, teacher-educated people are going to find the Alaska market. Since you do not have the rural, raised Alaskans going to the education field, the teaching field. So this is an effort to take advantage of the linguistic and cultural ties that these people would have with the students they've been teaching. And it's an effort to reduce the turnover in the rural schools. In addition, as the Senator pointed out, to create role models. Now, all those things were testified to very strongly during teleconference hearings, during hearings that were taken in rural Alaska. And it is acknowledged, of course, that the incentive intention is much higher than regular program. And I don't think anyone envisions it as a perfect bill or a perfect solution to the problem. But I haven't heard, in all testimony we have taken, anyone suggest that it's not quite possibly the best approach to this point. And not a horribly expensive one.
Did you want this kind of testimony?
Is that too perfect?
We can tell you that this is the best approach. We don't even like the bill, if you want us to.
No, I don't. What I'm trying to point out is that people who are concerned with the problem in rural Alaska and in the education establishment, almost without exception, have favored the bill as something that will help what's proving to be a very serious problem. And with respect to the number of these scholarships that are awarded at a time when the market might be saturated with teachers, I think that the commission has the discretion to allocate, doesn't it? Under this legislation?
No. The legislation determines the number annually.
That's right.
The legislature would determine which one.
Well, in all your testimony, you get testimony that indicated that there are high school kids out in rural Alaska that would, in fact, change their mind about what they're going to do with their life in order to qualify for this program?
Well, perhaps not ones that would change their mind, but ones that would make their minds up in that direction, yes. Quite a few teachers testified to indicate that they thought it would
help with the teachers.
But it's funny, they don't make happy. Yeah, obviously, there was a problem out there, but they addressed why these teachers, why they turned out. Specifically, why does it happen?
Well, it's a lot of reasons.
Is it an ethnic problem or is it a problem?
That's one part of it. See, we're not sending Alaskans back into the bush to teach Alaskans, right? We're bringing a high percentage of them are young college graduates from Western 48 who come up here for a year or two for adventure. And they get a belly full of bush in a year or two. And they go south again. Or they come to Anchorage.
Well, people living in the bush and come to the city get a belly full of bush too.
And they're I think the role model principle begins to come into play. Could help.
Just wanted that they indicate out there to the testimony that school boards or whoever testified, the administration or whoever it might be, that they had a large amount of applicants each year for the job.
Thank you.
15% for 2 years, 25% for 3 years, and 50% for 5 years or over.
You mean in addition to 50%?
No, 50% just period.
So that they would get less forgiveness than the other aspects?
Right.
Go ahead, carry on. They wouldn't get it as quickly as an individual or a great person. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You're talking about the same thing. Sure, you voice your argument. Yeah, but not. Mr. Chairman, would you also entertain, I'm not covering this matter of allocation, a provision that the Act expires on July 1, 1994, so see how this operates in 4 or 5 classes.
You don't have to make it that long.
Well,
make it 1985.
Said we're going to have 4 or 5 graduated students. Probably have, though, of course, we're cutting off at any point. So we might have students going in, getting 1 or 2 years into the program at the moment. You could suggest a phase out of that day.
Yeah, I'll take care of that.
Start a phase out of that.
And it seemed to be working by that time, Mr. Richard, because I made this a fair deal. This. How many years does the average guy have to come back and stay in Alaska to get to? What's the write-off now, Kerry?
It takes 6 years. 1 year, the first year is a grace year, and it would be for these individuals too. Then once they begin employment and they work, then they have to apply for 1 year. So 6 years, and they get 50% of the pay.
That's the maximum. That's what it's called here. 50%.
Fifteen,
and then they go to 25, and then 5 years over is 50%. So they're actually getting 1 year grace on less than the other. They don't actually be 6 years, they get 5 years.
They can have a fair amount of stuff. Alaska teachers have a fair amount of stuff. 60 different apps, which is like, yeah.
Mr. Brennan?
I have a different one.
We'll bring this back up on Friday. I want you to think about this over the next day or so. If it's something that has to be done in 15 minutes. We want to make sure we have enough support for it.
All right, Mr. Lieutenant.
We're not finished yet.
You want me to be finished.
I've already done all the things.
Are you excited?
No.
We have Senate Bill 528 relating to the spousal defense to sexual assault. I don't know all about that assault.
I hope that's not sexist and
surprising.
I hope husbands are going to be protected as well as wives.
Yeah, it's not good. I haven't worried about it.